Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. And it is my great pleasure to introduce to you your host for this excursion, co-author of the annotated Abbott and Costello, a gentleman who is a performer, a writer, a scholar, director. If he had an office, the sign on the door would say, oh yeah, he does that too. Just an all-around good egg, Nick Santa Maria.
Whoa! How are you? Some people think that good egg is a bit cracked, but that's okay.
Because we're all entitled being rotten.
We're all entitled to our opinions. But I want to thank Jerry Shario, my producer and genial sidekick on this. I like you said excursion. That's good. It's an excursion. It's a side trip.
Yeah.
During the epic of your life, your life story, we're a little turned down the alley, so to speak. Turn down the alley, you kids. You're driving me crazy. they're listening to Muhammad Ali records, you know. He said a few. Oh. He did.
Yes,
he said
yes.
A few of those records. We're off to a terrible start. So let's let's get started here. Now, Jerry, how you doing? I just want to salutations.
I'm doing well. Doing well, sir. How about yourself?
I'm well as well. So I'll meet you at
well.
It over. It's on my bucket list. But you know, there's these crazy kids today with their long hair and modern dancing. I'm forgetting why we're here.
Oh God. Well, that's part of my job is to remind you. So we're here to talk about Abbott and Costello's first major starring feature film, Buck Privates.
Yeah, that would be Buck Privates.
Yes, it would.
Or as Bing Crosby might say, Buck Privates, blah, blah, blah. So this is a miraculous story, actually, the story of Buck Privates. And I'm going to start off right where we left off on the last episode, where we looked at their first film, One Night in the Tropics, from 1940. And they were relegated to comedy relief, but they got to do some of their best routines with that wonderful new energy that they brought with them.
Yes.
And they blew the socks off the people and the critics, and they came away smelling like two burlesque roses. In fact, rose leaves. I would have said Gypsy, but it's not PC anymore. She's known now as Rose Lee. So anyway, we're talking about Gypsy Rose Lee. This next film features them more. Although, and Jerry, I'd like your opinion on this, I feel like they're still in comedy relief mode in this film. Yes, they've got more to do, and they do get top billing in the opening credits, not in the closing credits, if you noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I think Universal was still kind of dipping their toe in the water, you know, a little afraid of that shark. But yeah, this is their first where they actually are named above the title stars. And it came about in a very interesting way. When they finished One Night in the Tropics, they had a great time. One of my favorite interviews around that time is with Bud Abbott. And Bud tells the interviewer that this is the first time he'd seen them performing their routines. He'd done them 1,000 times, but he'd never seen them. And he said, you know what? I laughed like hell. We were damn funny. And he, you know, and who knew better than Bud, you know, he just knew it was lightning in a bottle. So when came time for them to close up shop on that film, they didn't have a contract to do anymore, but Lou decided to go back to the studio one day and say goodbye to everyone. And thank you. You know, that was his thing. So he drove to the studio, actually his brother, Pat, who is quite prominent in Buck Privates as a stuntman and as an extra. I keep spotting him, you know. But he drove Lou over, and Lou said, I'll be right out. I just want to say goodbye and thank you. He walked in. It took Pat says he waited outside for like an hour. And what Lou did was he said, you know, if you guys ever want to use us again, we have this wonderful like drill bit we did on Broadway and Streets of Paris. And he did it for them. And they loved it. And seriously. And then he talked about the candle bit, you know, which eventually came to Hold That Ghost. He sold them on those two ideas, just stopping to say goodbye. So right away, in Universal, in their executive little heads, decided this guy's got great ideas. Yes, yes. They're bringing the draft in right now. You know, it was about a year before Pearl Harbor. And we were sort of hesitantly getting prepared. So the timing was perfect. And eventually their manager, agent, Eddie Sherman, came in with the boys and he negotiated a two-picture contract for them. Yeah. And you know how that worked out. They were at the studio for 15 years.
Exactly. And that just goes to show you the power of saying thank you.
Yeah. You see that? You're a decent human being. You go in, you act decently, you get rewarded. You know?
Yeah.
So he was sort of a karmic comic, if you will.
Ooh.
Even if you want. I already said it, so it doesn't matter. So anyway, I believe that Eddie Sherman negotiated $3,500 a week for the boys, and he would not leave until they agreed to 10% of the profits. Wow. And Lou pulled him outside and said, "What the hell do you think you're doing? This is like, nobody does this. Nobody gets shares in the profits. What are you, crazy?" He said, "Trust me." And eventually they were making hundreds of thousands of dollars based on that one deal.
Wow.
Amazing. Amazing. Everything just opened up. Universal was putting everything they had on them. But they were still hesitant because the budget laid out for Buck Privates came to, they budgeted it as about $233,000, which was, you know, a B movie, basically. They went over. It ended up costing about $245,000, which is still a B movie. And they went over 4 days. They went over schedule 4 days. Mm-hmm. So instead of 20 days, it was 24 days. Can you imagine 20 days?
Wow. And,
yeah. So, yeah, they were set to make Buck Privates. So interesting the way it all turned out. I don't want to go right to the ecstatically happy ending right now, but when you think about it, this is a very special movie to Abbott and Costello fans, not just Abbott and Costello fans, but even people that don't like them very much know that this is kind of an important movie based on the timing more than anything else. We were on the cusp of going to war and the boys getting trained and shipped out. So this was extremely prescient at the time, and they were right on top of it. Now, I wanted to, if you don't mind, I wanted to read something from a chapter in a really good book called The Annotated Abbott and Costello.
I've heard about that.
You heard about that book?
Yeah. Yeah.
Matthew Conium and some boob from Brooklyn. But Matthew, my wonderful writer friend, he is just, to me, he's just, it was such an honor to write a book with him, especially it being my first. He writes about Buck Privates, and this is pretty much the way people feel. And remember, we're talking about a year before Pearl Harbor, before we were shoved into war. Buck Privates is not the greatest screen comedy ever. It's not even Abbott and Costello's greatest, but it's one of the most important comedies ever made. And one of the most cherished. Audiences did not merely enjoy it, they were grateful for it. This is how it was. The front line of popular entertainment in 1941. Kicking, shouting, singing, pratfalling, jitterbugging, side-splitting. Close your eyes and you can still hear the laughter. Isn't that beautiful?
Wow.
Oh, boy, that Mickey Spillane, he could write, boy.
Yeah. Boy, Matthew should do more writing. That was pretty good. Yeah,
I think Matthew has a future in that. Maybe copywriting or, you know, industrial writing, you know. But that just hit me. That just hit me between the eyes. Yeah. And that says it all, really. So, Buck Privates. First of all, I have a friend by the name of Doug McEwen, who is a writer and performer and used to write for a Los Angeles horror host, movie host. Mm. And since I didn't grow up there, I can't remember his name, but it was very popular at the time. And posters for him show up in Quentin Tarantino's movie about Hollywood. What is it? A Night in Hollywood? Or
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
In Hollywood, yeah. You see some of this guy's posters around there. And I know his daughter, and she was very thrilled to see her dad all over there. let's see. What was I saying just now about Abbott and Costello?
Your friend, the writer, yeah.
I was saying about Doug, my friend. Yes. Doug, he actually interviewed Bud Abbott. Bud Abbott was a very old man. He confirmed what everybody said about Bud when being interviewed or just having a visitor. He always had the TV on. anyway, which is such an old man thing to do. And he always had his flannel bathrobe on. That was another thing. Very show business to have a robe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so Bud told him that he thought Buck Privates was their best film. And I tend to disagree. I don't think it was their best film. But I think Bud liked it or liked the idea of it because, number one, it changed everything for them. They became movie stars thanks to this. Mm-hmm. This and under no uncertain terms. They were in the top 10. The movie made more money than Citizen Kane, How Green Was My Valley, The Grapes of Wrath. You name it made more money. The only thing I think that beat them was Mrs. Miniver. At MGM.
Wow.
Yeah. Two Oscar nominations. Are people sitting down? Two Oscar nominations. One for the best score and the next one for best song, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy.
Yeah.
Which brings us to another element to this film that makes it absolutely indelible. And that is the three Andrews sisters. Did they add to this movie or what? Mm-hmm.
Many times in comedies like this, you know, where they feel the need to stick in a love story and stick in musical numbers, even though people are coming to see the comics, you know, this having the Andrews sisters is not a time to go buy popcorn. You know, it's not something you fast forward through. They are so good in this. It was this movie. I'm pretty sure it was this movie that introduced me to the Andrews sisters.
Oh,
and
me as well.
Still love their music.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They are just terrific. Just terrific. And in this movie, they're terrific. And interestingly, I used to be a buddy of Harry Ritz, of the Ritz brothers. And this is the Andrews sisters' second film, by the way. Their first film was with the Ritz brothers, and it was called Argentine Nights. And that was the year before, 1940. And they saw the film and they offered Universal money to scrap the film and throw it away because they thought they filmed so hideously and they just hated it. And they hated working with the Ritz brothers. The Ritz brothers apparently took full advantage of the fact that these kids never made a movie before. So, but they got paid back. Let me tell you how. And Harry, this is right from Harry. The next movie they made was Buck Privates. Now, Universal did not pick up their contract after Argentine Nights. They just didn't think they were good enough, right?
Okay.
So the Andrews sisters walk away, and all of a sudden, their records are you know, hitting the top of the charts. And I mean, eventually 19 gold records, these three little girls, 19. So Universal was more congenial with them once they went out and proved themselves, you know. So they were signed up to do this film. And I believe they split $12,000 for the film. That's $4,000 apiece. And that's, you know, 1940 money, actually.
Yeah.
So it's not a bad deal. And it also set them in motion for a longer-term contract. And they made a few other movies. They never spoke well of their Universal films because Universal paid like, you know, they spent like a dollar, you know, on these films. If there were a 99-cent store for films, they would have gone there. But so the Andrews sisters, they were underwhelmed by their filmic legacy. But their next film was kind of based on the success of Buck Privates. And that was a movie that's very, very ubiquitous due to its public domain status. And that's Private Buckaroo. From 1942, where there was actually quite a good comedy team made of Mary Wicks and Shemp Howard.
Yes. Oh, they are so good in that. Yes.
They were wonderful. And in a lot of ways, it's my favorite solo Shemp movie, you know, because he's so good with her. And you know, she's such a good foil to him and really slaps the hell out of him. You work with Shemp, you got to slap, you know, you got to get used to slapping.
Well, I've got a quick question for you then. Yes, something please. I had read, something I had heard, maybe having, especially the Harry Ritz connection here, you might be able to confirm or deny this. In Argentine Nights, the piece I read said that Universal didn't spring for choreography.
No.
And so the Ritz brothers basically taught the Andrews sisters a few steps. It is so evident in Buck Privates to me.
This was watching the story the three of them. At. You jumped ahead. Okay. Harry told me that story personally. And yes. they did at least two or three of their set pieces, their set dance pieces, and used them for the rest of their careers. So Harry Ritz was actually the choreographer for the And, you know, the Andrews sisters didn't get a choreographer for Buck Privates either. They were pretty much left to their own devices. So it's interesting that the jitterbugging in this film, especially during they do a film called Beat Me, Daddy with a Solid Four, which I think is a great song. It just never gets attention because of Boogie Woogie Boo Boy, you know?
Yeah.
But we have to remember, too, that Apple Blossom Time comes from this. And that was one of their big, big hits. And that was the only old song in the movie. It was Albert von Tilzer, you know, who wrote, helped write Take Me Out to the Ball Game. That's how old he was.
Yes.
And baseball wasn't even invented when he wrote that. He was his writing partner was Nostradamus. That was predictable. But, you know, these crazy kids today with their long hair and Elvis.
Moving right along.
Yeah, moving right along. I do these things and then I forget what I'm talking about. I really do have short-term memory thing. And you know what? I have short-term memory problems. I do. So wait, we were talking about the song. So Apple Blossom Time is one that the girls recorded before this film was made. And they begged Universal to put it in the movie. And Universal said no, because there's a $200 charge that we have to pay to the publishers, and we don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So the Andrews sisters dug into their own pockets, if you will, and paid for it themselves. And it helped push that record up to the top of the charts. Wow. So Universal, so with such wisdom. So the producer, Alex Gottlieb, he produced most of their earlier films and then later on came back for Jack and the Beanstalk and Meet Captain Kidd. And he had seen the boys on Broadway and absolutely loved them. And Universal kept telling him, you're going to produce this movie, but we just want to make a few B movies with them. And we want you to helm them, you know, just get them out, do them quickly. And, you know, I'm sure the public will forget about them. And he was adamant. He was like, do you guys know what you have? Have you seen these guys perform? Have you seen how every strata of audience they appeal to? He said, I saw people paying top dollar on Broadway. These are rich, you know, very sophisticated people losing it watching these two guys. I guarantee that not only will this film be a hit, but these guys are going to be your biggest stars. That's what he predicted when they offered him the job. And sure enough, he was absolutely right. Abbott and Costello were Universal's main source of income for 11 years.
Wow.
They were also in the top 10. I mean, almost immediately, they were like in the top three of, the, of that. But they made it to the top, you know, the very top. Since they started looking at that chart in 1932, no comedy team even came close.
Wow.
Abbott and Costello, they were on fire. So the movie, it opens, very memorable opening, right? You had a cameo by President Roosevelt, right? Franklin Roosevelt, my friends.
It almost made you feel like you were watching the newsreel before the film actually started.
Yes, or Yankee Doodle Dandy. But, your family has given more pleasure. I love in the movies, whenever there's someone doing Franklin Roosevelt, it's like he talks to people one-on-one like he does in a speech.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, would you like more iced tea? You know, it's kind of like how Keith Brazell played Eddie Cantor in the Eddie Cantor story. For nerds out there, every line of dialogue, whether he was saying his grandma Esther died or, you know, he found a carrot in the street, he said it the same way Eddie Cantor said everything on radio. Oh, no, Russian, that's nothing but a lie. You know, it's crazy. Why would you do that? Why didn't the director say something? Why am I talking about this? Okay.
All valid questions, yes.
Yeah, all valid, I would say. The valet of Nick Santa Maria.
So the movie opens.
You just ba-dum-bumped me. The movie opens with an actual curtain. I noticed that on the Blu-ray. And before I forget, Lee Bowman is in this movie. He's kind of one of the leads. If you look really closely at the close-ups on the Blu-ray, you see the mesh from his toupee. All right. So these are the things that are important to me. One more legendary story, and this might well be apocryphal, and I'm going to tell you why after I tell you the story. Apparently, Lois Laurel, Stan Laurel's daughter, said that Abbott and Costello used to come over to Stan's house quite often for dinner. And one day they came to them and said, Stan, you got to help us. We have no finish for our film and blah, 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 blah. And Stan turned around and told them about his idea about the war games at the end of the movie, you know, where they're dropping sacks of flour, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's how Great Guns, you know, the Laurel and Hardy film made after Buck Privates. That's why they seem similar, blah, blah, blah. Now, I have a feeling, number one, I've never seen a photo of Abbott or Costello or Laurel or Hardy or any of them together. Now, there might be, and maybe Stan invited the newcomers to Hollywood, you know, to say, welcome, there's no hard feeling, we're both teams, blah, blah, blah. I totally believe that. Mm-hmm. Why there were no pictures taken or shared, I don't know. That puts the maybe apocryphal story. Also, I think Lois might have felt bad that people were saying so much that Great Guns was too much like Buck Privates. And maybe she felt a little defensive about that. Oh yeah, my father helped them with it. Well, no, Abbott and Costello had no say in the plot of their films. So that could not have happened. It just couldn't have happened. I'm sorry. And I know there are other historians that agree with me that it just seems like a little too far-fetched. Lois was a very lovely lady, a very sweet lady, but she might have just been kind of sticking up for her dad at that point. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was an interesting story. Yeah. But why no pictures? How come we don't see pictures? I see them with Hope and Crosby. I see them with Martin and Lewis, you know?
Yeah.
I don't see them with Laurel and Hardy.
Some lovely photos of Lou with Charlie Chaplin too. But
those are just wonderful. And by the way, this was the film that Chaplin saw when he told the press that Lou was the greatest comic working today. Now, can you imagine your boyhood hero?
Wow.
Yeah. Telling the world that you're the best. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's something about their story that just touches me. It's almost miraculous what they did. Now, the script is given sole credit to Arthur Horman, who was quite a prolific writer, wrote some of their other films as well. And then John Grant, who we know, our buddy John Grant, gets his very first, I think this is his first credit. He gets special material by John Grant. Now, John Grant was an old burlesque guy. He was a straight man on stage. He was a producer. He was kind of like Bud Abbott was, put together his own shows and became an encyclopedia of burlesque routines. And Bud and Lou called him as soon as they got hired for the Kate Smith show in 1938. They were on the horn with John Grant saying, come on, you're going to be like the third member. And he was for years and years and years. So he got his first credit. And Fred Rinaldo and what's his name? Lee and Rinaldo, who wrote some of their best films, including Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, also said that they were involved in this film as well, but didn't get any credit. That was not unusual in Hollywood. So the film opens with the draft, the first drawing number of the draft. Mm-hmm. It is literally newsreel footage, probably Universal. I'm guessing. And it starts the film. Buck Privates, and you know, you hear that rousing, "You're a lucky fella, Mr. Smith, to be living the life that you do. Get your leg off my wife's leg if you don't." Oh, wait, I'm singing something else. I'm sorry. That was a different version I learned yes. in the army. not our army. Oh, the songs. I should mention the song. It's probably the best score of any Abbott and Costello film.
Agreed. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, they stay in your head forever. But most of them are written by Don Ray and Huey Prince, who actually are in the movie, like all the way through it. Don
Where?
Ray.
Who?
Do you remember You're a Lucky Fellow, Mr. Smith?
Yes.
That they sing in Grand Central Station and they're all dancing and singing. Then all of a sudden they're on the train, right?
Yep.
They do the racist line with the porter. Uncle Sam's fairhead boy. the next guy they taught, the Andrew Sisters sing at, you know, about, oh, you got to think about all the stuff that you've got, is Don Ray. And he says, just take a look at the Constitution we've got. That's his line. I used to have a friend in New York who used to, he'd turn down the sound there and say, take a look at the lousy agent I got. La, da, da, da. And I would cry. I just think that's so funny. That's Gary Goldstein, if you're listening. but anyway, so yeah, that's it. They had a great, great, great score. As far as the cast, I know I'm going backwards, but I want to get all this stuff in before.
Fine.
You've got Alan Curtis, right? Handsome mm-hmm. Alan Curtis as the poor chauffeur who has to put up with Lee Bowman, you know, playing the rich Mr. Parker. And then they're both at odds over Jane Frazee, who is just cute as a bug's nose. She is adorable. She was for actually years before this, she was a part of a sister act, the Frazee sisters, with her mm-hmm. sister Ruth. And Ruth, and this is for all you Marx Brothers fans, Ruth got out of the business, retired in 1940 when she married one of Groucho's best friends, Norman Krasna. Norman wrote Time for Elizabeth with Groucho, yep. that very mediocre play. Groucho gives a very mediocre performance on the yep. television version of it, which is on YouTube. I'm sure you can find it. It's pretty dismal. His wife is in it as well. His wife at the time, Eden.
Yes.
Roland Winters is in it, who was the last movie Charlie Chan, if you don't count mm-hmm. Peter Ustinov. But anyway, Alan Curtis was a male model, and he was picked up by Joan Crawford. And I mean that quite literally.
Okay. She was,
yeah, Joni saw some promise in this young, good-looking fella and went to Louis B. Mayer and, you know, batted her eyelashes and said, you know, I'll keep batting until I get a real bat. And you sign. and she wasn't talking about his wife. So MGM signed Alan Curtis for the movie Mannequin, starring Joan Crawford and Spencer Tracy, in fact. It was one of his worst films, I think. But anyway, Alan Curtis apparently acquired quite an ego at that point and became very difficult to work with. So MGM kind of said bye-bye. And he showed up, they started showing up in Universal stuff and, you know, lesser stuff, let's say.
Yeah.
I don't think you're hanging around Schwab's drugstore saying, you know what, I got the second lead in an Abbott and Costello movie. You know, you know, I don't know how, but you know, you were seen though. The people were coming sure. in droves. Lee Bowman was an actor from Cincinnati. He studied mm-hmm. at the Academy of Dramatic Arts, and I always liked Lee Bowman. He always played kind of a little too slick other man. You know what I mean? He always yep. had a chance with the girl because he was handsome and kind of charming, but a little sleazy. You know, yeah. So that made it easier for like Van Johnson to come in and say, hi, oh, you know, and win the girl. But Lee Bowman, interestingly, in the last part of his career, he made his last movie in 1964 and he started coaching Republicans. Now, I know that sounds weird, but he was a devout conservative and he gave people like Eisenhower, Nixon, Ford, and CEOs of corporations, he would give them coaching on speaking. speaking skills.
Okay.
And he was apparently one of the best. He was fantastic. So that's how he wound up his career, helping
the enemy.
No, I didn't say that. You know I didn't say that. I did not say that. That was a Jerry cut-in. Yes.
Yes. Yes. I was doing my Nick impersonation. Yes.
You do very well.
Thank you. We may touch on this later, but one thing I found interesting about this film, talking about these three performers, to me, this is one of the few films of the period that I can recall where nobody ends up with the girl.
You know,
you've got the two of them kind of going at each other all through the film. And the final shot, you know, that big production number at the end, as they're all traipsing by the camera, they come up as a trio with her in the middle.
Right. Right.
And there's no winner.
Well, it might be a Noel Coward situation. It could be Private Law. Not Private Law. What is it? The one where the threesome gets together. It could have been that. But I did notice that. And last night when I was rewatching, I thought to myself, she's probably going to go with the rich guy.
Really?
I'm sorry, but doesn't seem to make sense. Well, you know, they're both handsome. They're both blah, blah, blah. But this guy can give me, you know, a boat. this guy's a chauffeur, you know? It's like, what does he have to chauffeur it? So that was a horrible pun. Basically, okay, so the movie begins, and Abbott and Costello are Thai salesmen, and they're working on the streets out of a suitcase. And they are noticed by a policeman, who happens to be played by one of my all-time favorites. And I know Jerry's given me the thumbs up, too.
Yep.
You remind me of my proctologist. And so this guy is Nat Pendleton, who has quite a pedigree working with the Marx Brothers, not once, but twice. Mm-hmm. He was in a great many of the Dr. Kildare series. He was the ambulance driver. Mm-hmm. He made a lot of great movies, especially at MGM during the 1930s. And his pre-code stuff is fantastic. And if you want to see what I consider to be Nat Pendleton's greatest performance, it's called Penthouse. And it stars Warner Baxter and Myrna Loy with Nat Pendleton in such a great role. And you're going to love him. You will just love him. Nat was screwed over by the Olympic Committee in 1920 when he went over with the U.S. wrestling team. And apparently there was a big controversy about the judgment on him that they, for some reason, went against him. And he got a silver instead of a gold. And people talked about it for years that he should have gotten the gold medal and didn't.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. He, in fact, it created quite a stigma in his life. He couldn't even use gold medal flour after that. It was devastating. But anyway, he was quite the athlete, he always played the big, you know, hulking guy, usually not exactly bright. But he was great in At the Circus. I thought he was one of the better things in the movie.
Yes. It wasn't hard to be one of the better things in that movie. But yeah.
Well, there was Nat Pendleton and the ostrich. Those two I enjoyed more than anything. And, you know, interestingly, there's another thing about the Andrews sisters, who were born in Minneapolis, by the way. I believe they were Greek-Norwegian, believe it or not.
Andrews? Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting looking girls. And on radio, they had a radio show. And on the show, the comedy writers actually used Laverne as the ugly one. They made jokes. Laverne was making jokes about how ugly she was.
Wow.
I seriously. I mean, that's, to me, she should get like a medal. She said, talk about being a good sport, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, and she was, you know, you have to admit she was the homelier of the three. I always thought Maxine was the cutest.
Okay.
Yeah. It turns out she's the lesbian. So.
Ah, well then. Maybe that's why.
Maybe that's it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But regardless, they had an opening gag that was cut by the censors, by the way. In the opening scene in Grand Central Station. And in the movie, Bud looks over and says, "Lou, look, look, it's those three little girls we were in vaudeville with. Don't you remember? Oh, the Andrews sister, you know," and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Originally, Bud was going to say, "Hey, look, the Andrews sisters." And Lou would say, "Who?" "Yeah, the Andrews sisters. Don't you remember? We played with them on the bill and so and so." And he looks, so he points them out, and the three of them are bending over at the time to pick up their trays. And Lou looks over and says, "Oh, yeah, now I recognize them." And for some reason, Joseph Breen didn't find it funny. Oh my God. Talk about the beginning of the end. They that was supposed to be their opening in the film, and it just didn't happen. I really love the scene where they go to the they run to hide from the cop who's going to arrest them for not having a sales license for selling their ties. So they run into a movie theater, and I'm not going to say it because I just wanted to run this opening for you. When they actually entered the movie theater, this is how they end up in the army.
"Herbie, quick, get in line. We'll hide in the movies.
Yeah, and when we get in, we'll stay a long time.
All right, get a couple of tickets."
"Okay."
"Oh, honey, a wise guy.
You want to fight? Take your coat off. It's much cooler this way, ain't it?"
"Oh." Mm-hmm.
"Go ahead, get a couple of tickets."
"Oh, what's your hurry? What's your hurry? We got rid of that dumb cop." "How much to get in?"
"Nothing. We're going to give you $21.
"Oh, bank night. Giving any dishes away?"
"No, 10 plates.
10 plates. What a novelty. Now we can start our new set.
Go on, step inside."
"Well, come on, or we won't get a seat."
"Hey, Usher! Hey, you! What picture's playing in here?"
"You're in the army now."
"Good. I never saw that picture."
"Calling Dr. Coldwater."
"Calling Dr. Coldwater."
"What's this calling Dr. Coldwater?"
"Must be a double feature."
"I guess so."
"Drafty?"
"No, not a bit. Do you feel it?"
"No."
"I feel very comfortable in here."
"Right over there."
"Hey, come on, let's register before the drawing starts."
"Think you're gonna win, huh?"
"Step right up, boys. Sign right here, please."
"Please? Boy, what polite ushers."
"Fine. And let me have your signature right there, please."
"I'd be delighted. And I hope I win."
"Well, congratulations, men. We're glad to have you in the army."
"Thanks." "What?"
So there they are, two hapless individuals, two street salesmen now... salesman for Uncle Sam. They are locked into. Now, I often wondered about this. What is it legit? I mean, if they signed under those circumstances, not knowing what they were signing, would that be legit?
Probably not legally. Yeah. However, you know, we're granted we weren't at war at the time, but
right,
and yeah, we weren't desperate for recruits. Yeah, the mores of America in the day, you know, would not have looked upon that.
I don't
know
anything about eels, but but I often wondered, even when I was a kid, would that hold up if they fought it? You know, we didn't know what we were signing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. They were sort of desperate for recruits at the time.
Isn't that how they got into the Foreign Legion as well later on? You know?
Yeah, something like that. Something like that. Of course, it wasn't a movie theater. It was they actually came to the Legion at that.
Well,
point.
Yes, but you know the whole sign your name here. Okay, now you're in. What?
Right. Right.
That's true. Anyway,
I think they. Bust
you think they would have learned
by that time? You know, it was almost 10 years later. For crying out loud! It was all Walter Slezak's fault. But anyway, who I love, by the way, I think he's one of the great villains of all time. So Bud and Lou are in the army, and that sets off a slew of getting into the army jokes. First off, of course, taking off your clothing and having to be examined. And this is where they do the thing with the weight, right? They're weighing in.
Yes.
They're weighing everybody. And it starts off with this really huge guy standing on the scale. And the doctor says, "Boy, you know, you almost missed it. Over 240 and you would have been out. You're 239 or whatever." Yeah. So we're set up for that. And Lou tells Bud, "Well, you're going to the army alone." And he points to his stomach and he says, "See this? 242. And we don't notice, but he's sitting on a heater that just happens to be there. Mm-hmm. And Bud plugs it in. And Lou is sitting there just burning up, of course, sweating like a pig. And he goes up, and of course, he's in the army by like a quarter of a pound.
Yes.
Thanks to Bud's machinations. very clever. So anyway, then there's the shot, the needle. Yep. You know, what are you afraid of? Oh, get shot. You'll get poked. And, that's it. And of course, Lou sees Bud getting poked and collapses into the medicine cabinet and then getting fitted for clothes and all this stuff. So I should mention that on the train, on the way to the fort, they do one of their greatest routines and one of my personal favorites, right up there with Who's on First and 7 times 13 is 28. It's the dice game. And I have to tell you, you talk about some of the things that, you know, like Gene Kelly choreographed, or some of the a beautiful comedy timing of Billy Wilder's scripts. This routine is so gorgeous and so beautifully put together. I just can't say enough about it. It's one of the set pieces. It's one of their greatest. You agree, Jer?
I do indeed. I've seen them do it in 2 or 3 different productions, and it never fails to entertain.
Oh, the one they do on the Colgate Comedy Hour, by the way, yeah, to me, this one is wonderful, of course. It's the first time they're on fire. It's just fantastic. But that one is so violently funny. he keeps pushing Lou, and luckily everything is cushioned, you know, so Lou doesn't get, you know, destroyed, but Bud is just killing him in this version of it. So anybody out there listening, if you get a chance, I'm sure it's on YouTube. It's their army episode of the Colgate Comedy Hour, not the TV show. They also do it on the TV show, and it's very good as well. And this one, I also enjoy watching the guys around them enjoying the bit as they're going. Apparently, Abbott and Costello still at this point were playing to the people on the set, and not to the camera or the way they were, or to each other. So they had to do several takes. And we'll talk about that later when we get to the drill bit, the drill routine. Mm-hmm. But the Abbott and Costello dice game is basically Bud trying to bilk Lou in a game he's not familiar with. And slowly but surely, we realize that Lou is much more familiar with the game than he lets out and ends up stripping Bud of everything he has. So it's really quite a beautiful routine. You want to listen to some of it?
Yeah, why not?
Let's do it.
There it is, boys. 7 is a natural.
Plain me.
Talk about hot dice.
Well, there goes my lesson for today.
What are you doing, boys?
He just gave us a lesson in dice.
Dice? Yeah. What's dice?
It's a game.
A game?
Don't you play games?
Yeah, I play jacks.
He plays jacks.
I'm up to my fuzzies.
Oh, behave. That's the game.
Will you teach me how to play that?
Will I teach you how to play it?
I should say I will. Will I teach him? You see, there's numbers on there from 1 to 6. Now, you roll them out, and if you should roll a 1 and a 6, that's a 7. That's a natural. You win. If you roll a 5 and a 2, that's 7. That's a natural. You win. If you roll a 4 and a 3, that's 7. That's a natural. You win.
That's all you do is win.
Well, no.
Oh, you can lose too.
Well, not often. If you roll a 1 and a 2, that's craps, you lose. If you roll 2 sixes, that's craps, you lose.
Well, you can win and you can lose.
That's
fair.
See, 7 you win and craps you lose.
Well, let's play.
You want to play? All right, here you are. You roll the dice.
Okay, now play for money. Huh?
Yes, we play. Now, how much you want to bet?
I'll bet $10.
$10, that's a good bet.
There you are.
Okay.
Now, good luck to you.
Here I go.
7 you win, craps you lose.
Here I go.
Go ahead.
Whee! 7. I win.
Yes, you win. Wait a minute, I forgot to tell you. Don't pick up the money right away.
I do get to pick it up.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's your money.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. You roll them again.
I roll them again.
How much you want to bet?
Fade that.
Wait a minute. Just a minute.
Don't get so loud.
Wait a minute. Where did you get that fade that?
What, I said something wrong?
No, you said it too darn right.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. You sure you never played this game before? All right. There you are. Go ahead.
Okay. Same thing?
Yeah, same thing.
Okay, can I go again?
Go ahead.
Woo! 7 again. I win.
Yes, you win again. Well, I guess it's beginner's luck.
Yeah.
All right, now what do you want to bet now?
Let it ride.
Let it ride. Wait a minute. Now, just a minute. Now, wait a minute. Now, don't tell me you got that out of thin air.
I heard it at the clubhouse.
That's what I thought.
I must confess.
Come on.
Well, there was a bunch of boys over in the clubhouse, and they had lumps of sugar, and they was throwing them out, and I heard one of the boys say that.
But you didn't play in the game.
They wouldn't let me. I was too young.
Oh, well, that's different. I didn't.
Starting Tuesday, I'm going out with girls.
I don't blame you, sure. Well, that's all right. Go ahead.
Okay.
I thought you played the game.
Same thing.
Here, four.
A little Joe.
Little Joe. Now, wait a minute. Now, just a minute.
Clubhouse,
yes. You learned an awful lot at that clubhouse, didn't you? Four is your number. But don't forget, if you throw a seven before you make that four, you lose.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You start. I'll be legitimate.
Yeah, you'd better be.
Where? Clubhouse.
Mm-hmm. Clubhouse, eh?
Three.
You lose.
How come?
Well, what did you roll the first time?
Four.
What did you just roll?
Three.
Four and three is what?
Seven.
I said seven.
Oh, you add them up.
Certainly.
You didn't say anything about adding them up.
Go down to the clubhouse and learn that.
That's not fair.
Now, wait a minute. We play my way now.
You mean I gotta use my money now?
For a change, yes. You've used mine long enough. I'll put it all down. Here, you don't care, do you? All right, now watch them. Here they go. Six.
Six.
Six is the punch.
Six.
Well, boys, watch this one.
Six again. You lose.
No. I win.
What'd you roll the first time?
Six.
What'd you just roll?
Six.
Six is 12. Craps, boxcars, big bennies.
Okay, the dice game. Little Joe. Now, let's admit it. I did not grow up. I was born in Brooklyn, but I did not grow up in Brooklyn. I grew up in the suburbs of Long Island. And okay. We did not do crap games. We did not play craps. It seems like in every old movie, everybody knew how to play craps. Everybody. I grew up
in Boston. Yeah. You know, I'm from Boston originally. Yeah. And you know, dice, maybe you used them when you played, you know, Clue or, you know, whatever board game. Yeah. But
my favorite Marx brother, by the way.
Exactly. Stratego. Yes. He's the sixth Marx brother. For me as well, this is how I learned about dice and how to play the game and what have you. Yeah. So it's an education.
Exactly. Bud was teaching Lou as he was teaching us, which reminds me, somebody, I think it was Kevin Brownlow recently fell upon another episode of the Bud Abbott Variety Show.
Oh, dear.
We're very excited about it because, you know, this is the third episode that we have. And we don't know how many more are out there, but I did want to play this short clip. If you don't mind.
I'm glad you are excited about it. So go right ahead. Yeah.
I'm glad you're a fan. So. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Bud Abbott Variety Hour. Yay! Here he is, everybody's favorite congenial host, Bud Abbott. Yay! Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. A little later on, we're going to learn how 7 times 13 equals 28. But before we get there, I'd like to introduce my very special guest. He's a little fella. He's on television. Here he is, Ronnie Howard.
Yay!
Hiya, Ronnie. How are you?
I'm fine, Mr. Abbott. I just...
Quiet! What are you talking
about? I'm fine, Mr. Abbott. I'm just...
Quiet! What is with you? Talk sense, Howard. Are you crazy or something?
Oh, Mr. Abbott, don't...
Quiet!
I think we need to cut away from that now. It actually gets violent. Later on.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was a long lost episode of that beloved show that we all grew up watching.
I should have stayed long lost.
Okay. Oh, so anyway, getting back to the.
Yes.
Actually, history tells us that Ronnie did not have freckles before he was slapped so violently. So that was a very interesting thing. So anyway, they get off the train and they do all the things that we mentioned previously. And they do their next big routine. And this is the one that sold the Universal executive on signing Abbott and Costello for 2 more films. I did say that Lou mentioned the moving candle bit to them as well, and they decided to do Hold That Ghost as well.
Yeah.
Or I should say they decided to do a horror comedy at that point. But things got different. That didn't happen. But it happened, but it didn't. That's the next episode we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
So the drill bit. the drill routine. Now, in burlesque, it's not known. I can't find any history of the drill routine in burlesque.
And
they're thinking that it might have come about for Streets of Paris, because that was like the big hit on Broadway. I think they did Crazy House too, and I think that was a big hit. But the drill bit, it slayed them every night. And that's what actually Alex Gottlieb, the producer, remembered more than anything else. So they had to put it in. And again, they had to do take after take because the crew just kept laughing. So every time Lou would get hit on the back of the head with the gun, somebody would laugh and kill the take, and they'd have to do it again. So Lou, after they finished up and, you know, they wrapped for the day, he made it known that he doesn't understand how they're going to get something out of this. You know, they did the routine 8,000 times on Broadway and they know it and, you know, whatever. And Arthur Lubin, the director, said, come to the dailies tomorrow morning and I want to show you something. And that morning, Lou learned about editing. He learned about cutting, and they took the best. Actually, they printed every take. Lubin said, print every take. So they had their choice. That is a combination of so many different takes.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a perfect routine and maybe the highlight of the movie. I don't know about you guys. I just think it's one of the funniest things they ever did. And I love the fact that they made the good choice of making Bud the sergeant in charge of training them, because by virtue of the facts, really, it should have been Nat Pendleton.
Right.
But they had Nat Pendleton say, I'm exhausted. You take over, you know, in true Abbott and Costello fashion. So it works out beautifully. It's just a gorgeous routine. Lou is, he's just priceless in it. Priceless. And then there's the famous ad lib where he threw at Abbott, what time is it? None of your business.
Yes. Yes. Out of nowhere. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, it's just beautiful to watch them work together. Yes, Jerry.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I'm aware that on their films, I think starting with this one, multiple cameras would be employed. Long shot, close up on Lou, that sort of thing, just for coverage.
Right.
Because they never knew what was going to happen. Had that ever been done before? I've not read or seen any information that says anybody had ever tried that before.
I always found it interesting. And no, I didn't either. But I always found it interesting that Desi Arnaz / who was the cinematographer, Carl Struss, who was the one? He was a famous Hollywood cinematographer, came and helped them set up I Love Lucy.
I think it was, yeah.
The guy who directed The Mummy. What the hell is his name? Anyway, he was probably in The Boys from Syracuse. and you please say I don't do self-deprecating humor.
But,
and Buster Keaton also was said to have a hand in that as well. Again, that might be apocryphal. I don't know. But actually, I think about Abbott and Costello. Lou actually told in an interview that sometimes they went up to 7 different cameras. Now, that sounds like an exaggeration, but he's saying a close-up on me, a close-up on Bud, a medium shot, another, you know, and then they would light the whole set. So no matter where they went, it was always lit. Laurel and Hardy worked the same way, but they never gave the right cues. They really didn't look at the scripts much, maybe more so in this film because they were so new. And from what Arthur Lubin said in interviews, they were just as eager as puppies to know everything about what was going on. I mean, that faded eventually, as it often does. Boredom sets in. You know, they started their legendary card games, you know, in between takes.
Yeah.
But at this point, they were eager beavers. Tell us what to do and we'll do it. So anyway, there's another thing I wanted to mention, another great bit, two actually, that I love in this movie. And one is, let's say you're in love with a girl 10 years old. You're 40 years old. You're in love with a girl 10 years old. Now, how the hell did they get away with this? Now, you couldn't marry that girl, could you? Not unless I come from the mountains. I mean, this is like, you know, that's stuff. That's adult stuff.
Yep. Yep.
But it's a great routine. It's so funny. And the other one I love is, loan me $50. Oh, how can I loan you $50? All I got is $40. All right, give me the $40 and you owe me $10. Yep. And then it goes on from there and ends with a pick a number from 1 to 10. It's these little bits that make the movie memorable, that make it mm-hmm. Bud and Lou's, even though they are comedy relief to this cockamamie story. Everything they do is like right on. It's right on the money. They even do a version of Go Ahead and Sing.
Yes.
Turn on the radio. You heard the sergeant. He doesn't want the radio. Oh, who's he? He's only the sergeant. You're an American citizen, aren't you? You know, that whole thing.
Yeah,
They repeat it in Society with honking the horn. You know, go ahead, honk the horn. But I love bits like that. That's when Bud becomes absurdist. You don't understand why he's doing this. Why is he putting his pal into jeopardy, into, you know, the fists of this huge sergeant who could kill him, you know? But anyway, okay, so we're heading into another big bit from time immemorial, from Chaplin in the early teens or mid-teens, all the way up to Jerry Lewis in Sailor Beware. There have been great, great comedy boxing scenes. My personal favorite Chaplin in City Lights is just tear-inducingly funny. But this one isn't bad, I have to say. Mm-hmm. Although I do have one thing I want to ask you, Jerry, because maybe you can explain it to me, because I've only been watching this movie since I'm like 7 years old, and I've only seen it about 350 times. But I never understood this one thing about it. In the movie, they have a challenge, a boxer who could go, you know, three rounds with whatever. Mm-hmm. And so Sergeant Collins, Nat Pendleton, volunteers Lou, right? And when Lou complains, he points to the corner and there's this scrawny little guy that Lou could use as a toothpick. And Lou says, oh, that's great. That's fine. I'll do it. Yeah, that's great. So in the meantime, they switch out the toothpick with a gorilla and Lou has to fight the gorilla. Now, Nat Pendleton, who apparently has a bet. This is a big betting thing, you know, from Company C to Company B.
Yeah.
And he becomes the referee. And he keeps fixing it for Lou to lose. You know, unless they cut out. Now, this is I make this point in the book. Unless they cut out a quick scene of him betting on the other team, then I could understand it.
Yeah.
But why is he trying to make his company lose?
Well, as I recall it, and, you know, again, I've probably seen it not as many times as you, but I've watched it quite a few times.
349, I think.
Yeah, I may be right at 300, you know.
Oh, okay.
But anyway.
You look younger to me.
Honestly, I don't recall an actual bet being placed.
There wasn't.
Or even mentioned. It was a challenge. You know, they introduce this fighter from whatever company who challenges to take on anybody from K Company, which is, you know, Bud and Lou's company.
Right.
But no wager was ever mentioned. That may also have been cut out.
You just assume, because the previous scene was about the rifle match.
Yes.
And it was a very, very heavy competitive thing that Company K lost. Right. So now, they have to save face. Why would Sergeant Collins make them lose in front of everyone? It doesn't make sense. I'm sorry.
Because he hates Herbie Brown that much. He'd much rather see him get the pulp beat out of him than, you know, have the company win the match.
Then imply that in the scene.
I got to tell you, that scene, it's one of my favorites. Yes, it's up there with the great boxing, comedy boxing matches ever put on film. But my son, from the time he was like 7 years old, just would get incredibly amused at the Herbie goes down and the sergeant comes in and says, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. And Herbie gets it. Wait. What's this? What do you mean? What happened to 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9? I don't like those numbers. They're odd. Well, put them in. I like them.
I love Edith Joe's on his underwear.
Yes. Or when he gets hit and his shorts, you know, he spins around in his shorts, you know, the heart was on the front. Now it's on the back, you know.
It's an excellent physical scene. It basically shows off that Lou not only was a great verbal comic, but he was a great physical comic.
Oh, yeah.
could have made it in silent film, as far as I'm concerned. That's mm-hmm. how good a physical comic he was. So, okay, so there's a classic scene. The boxing match is definitely a classic scene. And that leads into, I guess, probably my least favorite part of the film. And mm-hmm. that's when all of a sudden things get kind of serious. They have to do the war games, you know, and again, yep. they're competing against the other company in this. Yep. So there's a lot riding on it, and there's a few good gags in it. Lou walking off the cliff and landing on the tree up mm-hmm. above, and Bud saying, "How did you get up there?" "How did I get up there? I sat on it when it was an acorn." You know, that's a great joke, and they use it yep. a few times through the years. And then, you know, they have to blow up the blockhouse. And of course, the two leads that hated yes. each other throughout the entire film, one saves the other's life. And even when I was a kid, I loved the dialogue there. After he saves Alan Curtis's life, Alan Curtis looks at him and says, "You saved my life." And Lee Bowman says, "Okay, you owe me a nickel. Let's go."
Yes.
I love that line. So they are the heroes of the day. They're, you know, the company loves Lee Bowman again. He was a pariah for a while because he was the mm-hmm. rich boy mm-hmm. and blah, blah, blah. And again, there's nothing solved as far as the love triangle. And I think Universal took them a long time to realize that nobody cared. what's going on with Bud and Lou? What the hell's going on with Sergeant Collins? And the final gag is... Bud and Lou trying to take Sergeant Collins in a dice game. And yes. of course they end up losing Lou's pants, and he has to do the finale covered by a barrel. That says the end on the back of it, coincidentally, because it was the end of the film.
Incredible. Yes.
Isn't that incredible? That's one of Hollywood's mysteries that we, you know, we used to do shows about in the 1970s. Hollywood mystery. In Buck you know, Privates, 1941. What? I'm sorry,
Jared. No. You're fine. I just wanted to quickly insert here. One of my favorite lines, and I never got it until this last viewing. You know, it's amazing the things you can pick up on the 301st mm-hmm. viewing of a film. The two leads, you know, they're trying to vie for the girl's attention. Captain wants to see you. No, he doesn't. And then the sergeant comes in and says, "Well, didn't he tell you the captain wants him?" "Well, yeah, but I thought he would get out of here."
Right.
Nat Pendleton says, "The captain's been waiting so long, he's got corns on his hips."
Yes.
What?
When you sit in a chair that has two arms on either side, and maybe he's got a wide backside, you could get corns sitting there. You know.
Now you see, I went with hands on the hips, you know, fists to the hips, kind of a position. Well, you know, impatiently waiting.
I don't.
Either
know
one works, but still,
your sexual proclivities. But still, I feel. My friends. No. Apparently Roosevelt had corns on his
yes. head. I wouldn't doubt
he
it.
He did. Sitting in that chair for long periods of time will give you corn hips. And that led to the invention of corn chips, which put Frito-Lay on the map. And Frito is my favorite Marx brother. Why did you kill Frito, Michael? We'll just let Frito-Lay. So there's also a legend that the Japanese army used to show this movie to their recruits to show how ridiculous the American army is.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that something?
Wow.
Yeah. I've also heard the same thing about the Three Stooges, but who knows? Who knows if it's real? And I mentioned earlier Don Ray, one of the songwriters. Not only did he have that one line in the train for you're a lucky person, Mr. Person, he is the band leader that brings them in for Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. And he does all this dancing, this like kind of eccentric dancing.
Yes.
So I don't know. I never really noticed that before. And Huey Prince, the other songwriter, is all through the film. He's just everywhere. And he's like this skinny, homely guy. And he's in most shots when there's people around. So for some reason, they picked up some extra money. And then my final bit of trivia is, and this is something I've known for a while, Mike Frankovich, the great film producer,
mm-hmm.
Butterflies Are Free, a lot of movies, 70s, early 80s. He's in the movie. He's the announcer for the War Games behind the microphone. I'm Mike Frankovich. And he was Joey Brown's adopted son. Joey Brown adopted him and put him through school and everything else. And he became, you know, a sports announcer for a while and eventually one of Hollywood's biggest producers. Thank you, Joey Brown.
Interesting.
Isn't that?
My piece of trivia that I noticed this time around, Samuel S. Hines.
Oh, I love him.
Great character actor. I'm watching him in this. He plays the Major General in Buck Privates. And it's something hit, something struck. I know him. Where do I know him from? You know, that kind of thing, which led me down the rabbit hole of IMDb.
Yeah.
And not only was he Pa Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life, he shows up in three more Abbott and Costello movies.
Wait, let me go. He's in Buck Privates. Yep. He's in, is he in the Navy?
No.
No. Okay. Don't say. He's in Buck Privates. He's in Pardon My Sarong.
Yep.
He's in It Ain't Hay.
Yep.
And it's this next one. Ride 'em Cowboy.
Yes.
Woo. You'd think I wrote a book about this stuff.
Yep. And I have to say, I am not surprised, but I am slightly distressed at the fact that he played the native chief in Pardon My Sarong. But, you know, that was Hollywood of the day. So, you know.
It works. It actually works in the movie. He's just he's always so dignified. You know, when you wanted like a straight arrow, you went to Samuel S. Hines.
Yeah.
I think he was born in the 1870s.
Wow.
I believe, you know, when I hear stuff like that, I was doing research on some people the other day for my class tomorrow, and people born in 1854 living into the 20th century, you know, just amazing. So, this movie made for $245,000, ended up making domestically on its first release $1,000,004.
Wow.
Now that was, I mean, that's huge money. That's really huge money at the time. And it just not only became a hit, it went through the roof and into the stratosphere. And Universal, they looked at each other and said, "Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy." I actually read that quote in a book called The Universal Story. And, and their next film, which I'm going to set up now for the next episode, is a ghost story. They wanted to do a horror comedy, and they decided to call it Oh Charlie, and it was just your basic couple of comedians in a haunted house. But boy, they didn't see what was happening, what was coming next, because a major monkey wrench was thrown into those plans, and everything changed. So if you don't have our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, get it, and that way you could be ready for the next episode and be just as smart as we are. So, shut up, Ronnie Howard. and I think that's it. I think we've covered about as much of Buck Privates as you possibly can. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, Jerry. As usual, it's just been a wonderful pleasure.
As usual, yes. As always. And again, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, published by McFarland, available wherever fine books are sold, and even some not so fine books. So,
and even Larry Fine books are sold. Yeah. And if you want to find out more about me and my checkered career, please go to www.nicksantamaria.com. You'll see things from my past. You'll see me as the genie for Disney. You'll see me in, you know, film appearances, Biffle and Schuster, you name it.
Yes.
Come by and visit. And if you're not a friend of mine on Facebook, please change that. Send me a friend request and I'll be happy to welcome you aboard. I write a daily column every morning that you might enjoy. And that's about it. What about you, Jerry? What do you got to tell us about?
Well, I've been working on this podcast called Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast.
Such a waste of time.
Taking up a large amount of my time.
I'm
managing I'm managing to keep busy on stage every now and again, but well, yeah, I'm not an author. I'm more of an illustrator, which is hard to do on a podcast.
Yeah. So. Yes, it is. And you're funny. You look drawn. Okay. I actually went to an audition once where I forgot my headshot. So I immediately got a piece of paper and drew one in crayon. And I handed it to them and I said, sorry, I've been feeling a little drawn lately. And I actually got a call back.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah. Well, you figure, you know, you can't, what else can you do, really? Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot my headshot.
You make the most of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
So, okay, Jerry, it's been a pleasure. And I want to thank everyone for listening in. Our very first podcast was only put on, well, no, it's not, it's on all the platforms, but at first it was put on YouTube and we hit over 1,000 listeners on YouTube. And that's for our very first. So let's keep this going. We're really enjoying this and we hope you are too. So we'll see you next time on episode 4 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Be well.
You know, wait a minute. I'll take it easy. I'm on your side. Please be my friend. That sergeant always makes me boil. I'd like to fry that guy in oil. No matter what you do, he's always squawking. But you just wait and don't forget. I'll get to be a captain yet, and that's the day that I'll do all the talking.
3 cheers for the red, white, and Captain Brown. Happy, 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 hooray!
My buddy!
What did you do?
I'll scramble it later. When I become a captain, the title will be strictly unofficial. I won't be highfalutin', forget about salutin'. Step up and call me by my first initial.
3 cheers for the red, white, and Captain me. Hep, 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 hooray!
My bite! Snow, this time of the year? It's marvelous. Well, I'll see you later. When I become a captain, there'll be no bugle calls to spoil your slumber. There'll be no KP duties, and we'll draft a bunch of cuties. And instead of doing drills, we'll do the rumba!
What are you doing? What are you doing?
3 cheers for the red, white, and Captain Brown. Hep, 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 hooray!
What do you think is wrong with this army?
Glad you asked me that, my friend. And I can tell you in just 2 words. Polenti! Get the rest of the boys down here, I'll tell you.
Come on, fellas.
Now, the way I see it, there's too much coal and too much heat, too many MPs walking a beat, too many hikes and too many marches, too many feet with fallen notches, too much water in the soup, too many pairs of pants and troop, too many orders, too many drills, iodine and quinine pills, too much mud and too much rain, too many aches and too much pains, too many blisters, too many corns, too many drums and too many horns. Too much working like a slave, too many spots that need a shave, too many rules and too much law. Well, it's the darndest mess I ever saw. 3 cheers for the red, white, and Captain Brown. Hep, 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 hep.
So you want to be a captain, huh? Well, I've had a talk with the general about you. And we've decided to make you an admiral.
Admiral? Ooh. Do they have admirals in the army?
Sure. We're going to put you in charge of all the vessels.
Oh, goody.
3 cheers for the red, white, and Captain Brown.
Vessels.
Hep, hep.